Welcome to Voice for Choice podcast, the podcast that focuses on China issues with special attention to the Central and Eastern European perspective. I'm your host, Karanya Mečková. Here to discuss the ever closer Russia-China ties is Dr. Thomas Eder, postdoc researcher at the Austrian Institute for International Affairs. Hello and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
You have been tracking trade volumes between China and Russia, as well as the levels of investments of China and Russia. What do the numbers tell us about China and Russia's relationships 2 years into the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting issue because people tend to say now that Europe scaling down its economic relationship with Russia didn't really do much because Russia just shifted to the east and just trades and gets investment from China, and that just evaporates the effect of Europe's measures. But that's not true. China has been able to shift oil exports to the east, but it hasn't been able to shift gas exports to the east. And just when you look at the overall trade numbers, the EU-Russia trade has gone down, the monthly trade volume, by $16 billion, and the China-Russia trade volume has only gone up $3 billion. So that's only a fraction of what Russia has lost since January 2022. So I think that's a really important first point. And on investment and other issues, the difference is much starker still between what Europe really meant to Russia and what China now means to Russia. The foreign direct investment flows into Russia until 2021. Well, a lot of that was round tripping, so it was Russian citizens or companies funneling money abroad and then funneling it back. But a lot of it was also individuals and companies, mostly from the West, who were generally interested in investing in Russia, and Europe was very important there. And the level of investments in 2021 was $40 billion. And afterwards, Russia has just been hemorrhaging direct investment. It's been in the negative. Flows have gone out. And from China, as far as we know, at least as far as it's reported and publicly known, has not been interested in investing a lot since February 2022. The numbers are just in the hundreds of millions, not in the billions. So it's certainly not made up for the loss there. And I could add a third factor, and that's commercial bank lending from Western institutions to Russia and Russian clients. Was more than $100 billion outstanding at the beginning of the war, and there's really been only fairly little movement since then from Chinese commercial banks to step in.
One of the key sectors where we have seen a lot of cooperation, obviously, is energy. So when we look at the energy flows, what does it tell us about the story?
So as I said, with oil, it's rather easy. The drop in Russian exports to Europe has perhaps not one-to-one, but been replaced by Russian exports to China and India and some other countries, but mainly those two. Turkey is a bit of a different issue here. Refined petroleum products are very important, and gas. But that gets us to gas, and what Russia has not been able to do is to reroute gas exports from Europe to China as the target region. So neither with liquefied natural gas, nor with gas that is exported via pipelines. In 2023, the EU has still bought more Russian gas than China did. The liquefied natural gas was bought by Spain, France, and Belgium, and the gas exported by pipeline has been bought mainly by Austria, Hungary, and Slovakia. So why is that a problem? Well, because one important issue is that infrastructure is lacking. So there is the Power of Siberia 1 pipeline that Russia can use to export gas to China, but the Power of Siberia 2 gas pipeline that it had hoped to realize very quickly, especially with the escalation of the war in February 22, has not yet even been fully negotiated and agreed upon. Construction would take a considerable amount of time, and then really ramping exports up and using the full capacity of the pipeline. So I think it would be very difficult to realize Power of Siberia 2 and use the full capacity before the end of the 2020s. So this is really a challenge for Russia to reroute these exports via pipeline. Of course, liquefied natural gas is a different story, but still not that easy. So this is number one, infrastructure. But number two is also that China has always been very interested in diversification. So this goes for everything. It also goes for energy. It also goes for gas. So it doesn't want to be too reliant on imports. It wants to produce a lot itself. And when it comes to imports, it doesn't want to rely too much on one supplier. It also doesn't want to rely too much on its vaunted friend, Russia. It doesn't want to be exposed, be vulnerable, be dependent. It's just not likely that China would just expand this to levels that we've seen Russia export to Europe in the past.
So what is in Chinese interest when it comes to the war in Ukraine, to have a prolonged conflict or to have one of the sides to take over the other?
Well, it's interesting when you read the Chinese expert debates, academics and think tankers, and how they discuss how Chinese interests are impacted by the war. I think it's a fairly broad spectrum of opinions still, and a rather nuanced discussion. Of course, there's advantages in the sense of maybe the US being distracted, maybe China having economic opportunities in Russia that it didn't have before. It can get energy, as we talked about, fairly cheaply. Has even more leverage vis-a-vis Russia than it did before, and can get good deals. Can also invest in some places where Western companies and investors have left after February 2022. But in the Chinese debates, it's very prominently pointed out and published still within China that Russia's war also goes against China's interests, because China's economic relationship with the European Union is much more important than its economic relationship with Russia, and Europe has become much more aware of the dangers of vulnerabilities, dependencies, has pushed the buzzword of de-risking more in the eyes of these Chinese experts, also because of the war, because it's become painfully evident for Europeans how dependent they were on Russian oil and gas and petroleum products. They do not want to be as dependent in the future. They might be already, but in the future on China when it comes to minerals and other critical raw materials that are necessary for renewable energy and batteries and EV vehicles. So that's where the Critical Raw Materials Act comes in, and the EU trying to already address this issue before a situation could arise where it would be difficult to get these resources from China, like it is difficult to get these resources now from Russia, or being in a situation where getting them from Russia would be against European interests, and in the future the same might apply. This is against China's economic interests in the eyes of many Chinese scholars. And they also discussed the war potentially being against China's security interests because Northeast Asia's stability and security situation might be impacted. So at least in the eyes of Chinese scholars, the war has had an impact on debates in South Korea and Japan with regard to whether they should in the end get nuclear weapons for themselves, or at least have a nuclear sharing deal with the US. So the majority of the South Korean population is already in favor of nuclear armament, and according to Chinese debates, this war has had an impact, and of course this war is one where a nuclear power has attacked a non-nuclear power.
I happen to know that you are a sort of a mythbuster when it comes to Sino-Russian relations. So what are some of the widely held beliefs that you think people don't get right about it?
Maybe this is a situation where there's more myths in the debates in Vienna than elsewhere. So forgive me if these are not myths that need to be busted for you. But at least in some wider European and Western debates, also in Washington, D.C., these are still held. One of the two I'm going to mention. So the first one, that China and Russia can be divided. This is also something that parts of the Republican Party still advocate, that it's possible to tear the two apart and to sort of enlist Russia in the U.S.'s struggle competition with China, which is certainly not plausible, not realistic under the current leadership, and it's in Moscow and the current leadership in Beijing, and it's very unlikely that immediate successes in Moscow or Beijing would make this sort of scenario plausible. The two have intrinsic interests in having a very close relationship that have to do with both being authoritarian governments interested in staying in power, either the personal regime in Moscow or sort of the clique around Vladimir Putin, or the party in Beijing. Both have some similarities in the concepts they want to push for global governance, for international order, and want to support each other. And of course, both have the two have a very long border with each other, and they need security and stability on that side in order to be more assertive in another direction. So both think they need each other in their respective and different struggle with the West. China certainly thinks, and Chinese experts also think, that China needs Russia as a security partner, not an ally, but a security partner in the competition with the US. So this is the first myth that is still held by some, and it's just, I think, unhelpful and unrealistic. And the second one is the opposite, if you will, that the two will do everything for each other. And I'm going to focus on China here, and people are sometimes thinking that because China needs Russia against the US, that it will do everything for Russia. So I think this is also a myth and unhelpful, and again, black and white thinking as the first myth. Because, of course, China's foreign policy and security policy is more complicated than that. It's not just about Russia. So I take it to be sort of consensus among many in the community that the two core goals of China, the Chinese government, are for the Chinese Communist Party to remain in power and for China to become more powerful than the US by mid-century. Still in a multipolar order or a bipolar order, but overall more powerful than the US in a very sort of comprehensive definition. So in order to do that, Chinese side thinks it needs Russia as a security partner, but it also needs to keep growing and growing strongly, and it needs to keep innovating or it will not be able to compete with the US. Now, the EU being the most important export market for China, unless you count the very loose ASEAN as one export market, and it's only a bit stronger, China needs the money it generates out of these exports to the EU. China has also been hemorrhaging foreign direct investment. It's not in the negative like Russia, but it has received less and less over the last few years, and it's quite a strong trend, and it tries to motivate foreign investors to return and attract them again. And European investors are a very important group here to target. And besides trade and investment, the European side is also a very important research and innovation partner still of China. And China thinks that in all of these regards, it's probably going to inevitably lose the US. So another very important economic partner. It might also, if there is indeed a war in Taiwan Straits, lose the US's allies, maybe partners in the Western Pacific, so most importantly, Taiwan itself and Japan and South Korea, Australia, which are also very important for China. So that's not exactly an enviable position, and you don't want to just be reckless and lose the EU as well at the same time if you don't have to, and you certainly don't want to lose it over Russia's war in Europe. And Russia's interests, not your own direct Chinese interests. So this is why I would also say that it's very much mistaken to think that China would do everything for Russia.
So you think that a scenario in which China would send weapons to Russia, I mean openly not the dual use items, is out of question? Or can you see a situation in which that could actually happen?
Mm. So, obviously, there's been reports of China already, or Chinese companies, already making many things available to the Russian side. There's been reports about commercial satellite imagery and about uniforms and helmets and bulletproof vests and about navigation systems and radar systems, also for helicopters and component parts for even fighter jets, about handheld weapons, machine guns, and I guess this is about the list. But I think there's been a clear line not to cross, and that is so-called heavy weaponry and ammunition for that, certainly at scale, in a substantive way, and in a way that could then very likely be discovered by the Ukrainian side and by international researchers quite quickly on the battlefield. So I think it is very unlikely that China would export substantial numbers of main battle tanks or infantry fighting vehicles or artillery, substantial amounts of ammunition for that. Can I imagine a situation where it might do so? I think the main point I would make here is that China would probably rather escalate its efforts to avoid that situation coming about if it sees the danger of such a situation maybe arising. And I think it has many other levers to pull for example, avoid a situation where Russia would become pro-Western again, which I think is not a large threat, a large risk in China's eyes. I think the Russian opposition leader has just died, and there is no visible strong democratic opposition in Russia. And well, no matter if we use the word democratic, I don't see a strong visible pro-Western opposition in Russia. So it's very likely that if Vladimir Putin should at some point leave office in whichever way, that his immediate successor would still be very critical of the West, and very well, also because there would hardly be a choice, very pro-China and in favor of strong relations. So I think that when some people discuss the scenario of, well, but if China perceives a threat to Vladimir Putin's position, then they need to forget about all red lines that they think about, also with view of their relationship with Europe. No, I don't think they do. I think they have other options, and I don't think that it would be necessary for them to then really jeopardize everything they have with Europe in order to save Putin's position.
Is there any way the EU can somehow influence China's approach towards the war? Is there anything we can do?
Well, if we, with this question, think about whether we can make China turn its back on Russia, no. I don't think there's a possibility there, and this goes to the first quote-unquote myth that we addressed about whether it's possible to split China and Russia. I think the Chinese conviction, well, in the party leadership and also among experts, that China needs Russia is too strong, and that it should not, for the sake of defending Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and for the sake of defending EU interests and maybe other interests of Ukraine's partners and China's relationship with these countries, forsake Russia now. They do not think that they should do that, and it's very unlikely that they will. I think what realistically one can focus on in Europe is just to minimize the support China lends to Russia, to stave off escalation of Chinese support for Russia. And I think in this regard, it's very important that China does not perceive Europe in the same way as it perceives the US. So I mentioned that the Chinese side already calculates with losing its relationship with the US gradually, and perhaps in an accelerated way after the elections in the US this November, and perhaps even abruptly if there should be war in the Taiwan Straits. Now, to put this in one sentence, China thinks the US is lost. It cannot think that Europe is lost. Because if it thinks that Europe is lost already, then it would make much less sense to keep to the quote-unquote red lines that I've talked about. You don't need to protect a relationship that is already lost. So I think it's important that we have stable relations between the EU and China at the moment. Of course, relations where there is tension, where there's disagreement, where there is perception of the other side acting against one's interests to a certain degree, might even be a relationship that is on a sort of slow downward trend, but still a relationship that is somewhat stable, and I guess the Biden administration would say that has guardrails. A relationship where there is hope from the Chinese side that it can still be very lucrative on the economic side of things, and perhaps with a view to different aspects of that. And perhaps it's surprising, but there seems to still be quite a constituency in China that thinks still that in this multipolar order to arise, it is possible to put some daylight between the EU and the US and have strategic gains for China through that. Now, I think it has advantages for Europe that there is this constituency, and I think it should not disappear at this moment in time. So I think these two points, China still hoping for a lucrative economic relationship, and some in China still hoping for some strategic gains by a certain distance between Brussels and Washington, these can keep China from drastically escalating its support for Russia, and I think this is the most Europe can hope for.
China has used this conflict in Ukraine to position itself as a global peacemaker and global responsible power. My question is its messaging or its diplomacy, diplomatic initiatives, which are supposed to impress the global south or communicate towards the global south, is it working?
Well, I think it's quite interesting how this has been discussed also in Europe. Of course, what China has done with this proposal for a political settlement is very vague in the text. It doesn't touch on difficult issues, because China is in a sort of difficult place also, because it doesn't want to suggest anything that would be hard to swallow for Russia, because it doesn't want to upset this relationship. Thinks Russia is important. But on the other hand, China also still sticks to the official language of valuing the UN Charter and valuing sovereignty and territorial integrity very strongly. So if it comes out against these, by coming out against Ukraine very strongly in its proposal, that is also a problem. So it needs to be vague. This might be an issue when you think about this as a really concrete peace proposal, and China already being on its way to being a successful mediator, but that's not how you should think about this. The audience is the so-called global south. So the audience is developing and emerging markets, countries in other continents, and China is trying to build its image as a peaceful power, as a responsible major power, also in contrast to the US in the Chinese narrative, because in the Chinese narrative, the US is quote-unquote pouring oil into the fire. In the Russia-Ukraine war, and China is not. China brings peace. So this is the narrative, this is the image China wants, and the sort of the add-on to that image is that with the peace, China also brings food security. China helps bring about lower prices for grain, clear the export routes for everyone again, and this is why China is the one that helps developing country interests, and this obviously also goes along with the new white papers, policy proposals from the Chinese side on global governance reform. There's one from last fall that brings sort of everything together with the I think it's called Proposal for Global Governance Reform, and it brings in the so-called Global Development Initiative and Global Security Initiative and Global Civilizational Initiative, and further proposals for further development of global governance with regard to new areas like AI and so forth. And also talks about the UN Security Council. And everything China tries to do here is to say that the US and its allies and partners have not taken care of developing country interests, and China's new order will take care of developing country interests. So has it been successful? Well, it's a mixed picture, as has been much debated in Europe as well. When you look at UN General Assembly votes with regard to the Russia-Ukraine war, and when you look at G20 statements, and when you look at the International Court of Justice and what it has done, but generally, I would say this has not gone in a direction where China would feel that it doesn't have to exert caution in how much it supports Russia. Because, and this has been also prominently debated in Chinese expert debates, the amount of countries from the so-called Global South voting for Ukraine, not Russia, and not abstaining, but voting for Ukraine in the General Assembly has been very high, especially in the beginning, when there were multiple votes with more than 140 countries voting for Ukraine and not acting in the same way as China, which abstained. G20 statements, very critical of certain actions from the Russian side. And also the International Court of Justice, the UN Court, when it called on Russia to immediately withdraw from Ukraine, it was a 13-2 vote, and only the Russian and Chinese judges voted against. All the judges from the so-called Global South, from Africa, from India, voted with the majority and with Ukraine. So this has certainly given the Chinese side also pause in how popular Russian actions are in the so-called Global South.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This was Voice for Choice. If you would like to know more about our work, please do visit our website at chinaobservers.eu. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. We hope you'll make the right choice and tune in for the next episode of Voice for Choice.